Welcome to NucleCast, the official podcast of the NY Deterrence Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Laufer, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. The NY Deterrence Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrence and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Welcome back to another great episode of NucleCast. Of course, I am your host, Adam Lowther, and today we have a great guest. He was with us not too long ago, but some topics in his area have risen to the top of the discussion, so we thought we'd have Brent Sadler back. Of course, he is a senior research fellow at the Heritage Foundation and a retired captain in the U.S. Navy, and so, of course, when things that deal with the Navy's two favorite topics, that being Asia and submarines, although the surface fleet matters too, I was a surface guy. But when those topics come up, Brent's the guy we call. So thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me back on your show, Adam.
So President Trump, you know, recently made a trip to Asia, in which, you know, he solved another conflict between Laos and Thailand. They visited with the Prime Minister of Malaysia. He met with the new Prime Minister of Japan. And apparently he also made a promise of nuclear submarines to South Korea. Now, this for the South Koreans, I work with the South Koreans quite a bit. You know, this is a big deal, the discussion, the potential for South Korea to have nuclear submarines. So can you tell us a little more about that? You know, exactly what's going on? You know, what is real? What is hyperbole? And what is the realm of the possible?
Yeah, thanks. A great and timely topic. So I'll be very honest. There's a lot of details that are not known about the president's statement about South Korea or helping South Korea build nuclear submarines. And he goes further to say in Philadelphia shipyard with Hanwha. So there's some challenges in that, and I'll kind of get to that. But I did want to say up front also that the president's trip to Asia was very successful. And I would view it as a flex in a lead up to his meeting with Xi Jinping. That was the pinnacle of what everything was focused in on, and is setting the table so that Xi Jinping understands the United States, with its allies, Japan, South Korea, and others, the Philippines most notably, are acting together in a very strong way. And that, you know, just before they had their meeting, there was the announcement of nuclear testing resuming. And we perhaps touch on that a little bit, I think, later. But when it comes to this nuclear submarine deal with South Korea, it's challenging. It took about a year and a half after the AUKUS deal with, you know, with very close allies, Australia and the U.K., in the UK, we've had a, you know, very long-running nuclear program shared between the two of us for nuclear submarines and nuclear weapons. To grow that to include Australia was challenging enough. Adding in South Korea to a similar, it's going to take a while to kind of figure out all the details. But there's some interesting opportunities. The naming of Philadelphia might mean that there is a commercial use for this nuclear power. And this is something I've been very much engaged in advocating for as an American comparative advantage in trying to regain our mojo, so to speak, in shipbuilding. And it's nuclear power. It's small modular nuclear power plants on large commercial vessels. So there might be a dual use case. And one just looks at a Chinese conventional submarine that was being backfitted with one of these type of reactors last year to kind of see that it's not a novel idea necessarily.
Yeah, it's, South Korea is one of the largest shipbuilders in the world. And, you know, what's interesting is in conversations I have with the South Koreans, part of what they want to do is convince me that we should become, a strong partner in shipbuilding with them, in the sense that American ships, American military ships should be built in South Korean shipyards. Now, to say that they would come back here to the United States and we would build them, that strikes me as, like you said, that's quite quite difficult because we just don't have the capacity. We can't build the ones for ourselves that we need to build, you know, in the at the pace that we want to build them. So how would we add the, you know, building not only our own, but building ones for the South Koreans?
Yeah, we got to step back away from the naval shipbuilding part of this to really kind of see the full picture. So to set the kind of set the context, because of environmental constraints on fuel that the commercial ships use, it's created a lot of uncertainty for shippers. The shippers are the ones that move cargo. They're the ones that buy the commercial ships. So they've been holding off placing orders for like the last 3 or 4 years because they don't know, is it going to be ammonia? Is it going to be hydrogen? Is it nuclear? Is it something else or none of the above? So the demand for ships, and again, the fleet went through, the commercial global fleet went through a surge about 20 years ago. And that surge, those ships are now reaching the end of their life. So every year for that's been kind of like hit the pause button on or forestall the purchase, it just means the demand for new ships is going up. So the reality is, in very short term, in the next few years, the global demand for new commercial ships, think LNG carriers, think bulk carriers, think ultra large container ships, is going to surpass the global capacity to build, going to drive the price up. That kind of predictiveness makes it lucrative to grow your business, your ability to grow, build more ships because they're going to cost more to make that investment. And so now you're seeing companies like Hanwha invest in the United States and Hyundai also, but they're not the only ones. The Japanese promised about $6.5 billion, much more modest than the South Koreans, $150 billion here in the United States. But they know if they're going to grow their market share, they can't do it domestically. They have to grow their industrial footprint overseas. And the United States is and has been made to be a favorable and a more lucrative environment. It's definitely a safe one to grow your industrial production. So the way we're going to do this is not America alone. It's going to be America with its allies. And that's been kind of the construct for the last few years. And we're just starting, it's just starting to break out into the public scene to kind of register that this is real. And there's lots of money behind it. And it also makes good strategic national security sense as well.
One of the things that we've sort of been reluctant to do, we the United States, is to share much of the technology that is in these submarines. Are we at a point now where we're willing to share? I mean, clearly Korea is a very close ally. But are we willing to share that kind of technology with South Korea?
I'm not even so. It was hard enough to get this with the Brits and the Australians because we're talking about an advanced submarine design. This is the power plant that goes on a Virginia-class nuclear submarine. Now, our naval reactors folks are probably a couple generations ahead because they are working on the next generation of submarines. And that means the next generation of nuclear power plants. So it's like one step behind, perhaps, but still pretty advanced. I guess my point would be, for the type of military operations the South Koreans would want to, and need to support, they're near abroad. So this is the East Sea, some would call this the Sea of Japan, the Yellow Sea, and also the East Sea. These are right next to them. And they're right next door to a lethal enemy of North Korea. So their war is close. It's not a distance shipping lanes they have to worry about as much, as long as they've got good allies like the United States. So a diesel submarine that's backfitted with a new modular reactor so that it can stay at sea and it can sprint at high speeds longer than the batteries normally would allow makes a lot of sense. It also fits nicely into what their domestic production back home for their submarines is. So I don't know the answer which path they're going to go. And I don't even think even those in U.S. government or even the Korean government know yet. Again, it took a year and a half to sort this out in the AUKUS announcement before they figured out the so-called optimum pathway. So we're far away from that, but I can see a path where we both benefit, where we develop a small modular nuclear reactor, fits and can be used commercially while they use it and backfit it on their submarines to enhance their endurance.
Now, one question I really don't know the answer to, and that's sort of how does, because China or South Korea has nuclear power, and therefore they're under, you know, IAEA safeguards, yep, and follow those regulations as part of, you know, the nuclear supplier group and the NPT. And would having nuclear power submarines impact that at all? I honestly don't know. Do you have any sense, yeah, of what those sort of impacts might be?
No, it's still a political issue, but I think technically it was a question that I got asked frequently when AUKUS was announced back in the fall of 2021, and it lasted for a while. It has to do with the fuel, the nuclear fuel. So if you're using like a military design, you want a very small reactor with a lot of energy. That means you have a high energy density, even more than you normally would get in a civilian nuclear reactor. That means you have to have a much higher enriched uranium than you would want normally for just power generation, because you're putting it in a smaller area. When you start enriching that uranium up higher and higher grades, you start to get to weapons grade capable uranium and fuel. And that becomes a counterproliferation or a proliferation issue. Now, if you're building something like the Australian submarine, the fuel is built in such a way that you could never use it for weapons in the fabrication process. So much the same with the South Koreans, but I would say better yet, use a new design like a small modular reactor, and it's using a different type of fuel that, again, you can't repurpose it, and it's also not enriched necessarily to a level that starts to tip the proliferation concerns. So it really matters which way the South Koreans and the U.S. government wants to go. If they want to replicate AUKUS, that's a very tough security challenge, information-wise, that might delay things for a very long time, but it's also an engineering challenge. But if they do with a small modular reactor, I think they address the proliferation issue a lot easier, and I think the engineering problems are a lot less than it might seem on its surface.
Now, we're just at the beginning stages of this discussion. There's sort of no clear path. You know, it hasn't been worked out. It's sort of one of those good idea fairy. You know, that's sort of where we are right now.
Yeah, early days for sure.
Okay, so let's now turn to the visit between Xi and President Trump. So tell what happened. Did it go well? Did it go the way we wanted?
I gave this a very low bar. So the right way to look at this is there's no winner or loser in this, because this is just the first round. It's like a boxing match. It's going to go for like nine rounds. And this is just the first bout. Both parties are still in good spirits. Both haven't really given much. It definitely appears to be off to a good start for a productive exchange. But again, this is just the first round of probably many. The next bout's going to be by April, when Xi and Trump are supposedly going to meet again. So if they meet, that would be a success, I think. But if you're asking, like, by all appearances, it appears that I would say the United States definitely got more out of this, because it was clear that Xi Jinping wanted this meeting. Because despite the fact that President Trump had set the table and he set the context, his trip to Malaysia for ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Nations, was a huge hit. He helped seal a treaty between Cambodia and Thailand, ended a war, had huge goodwill with the Malaysians in Kuala Lumpur, where I lived and worked before. And then he moves on to Japan, seals more deals, more commitments of defense, shipbuilding, goes to South Korea, doubles, triples down on the same thing again. Everyone, all of our allies are very much in one voice. And then moments before he sits down with Xi Jinping, he announced he's going to restart nuclear testing. All of that together, I would characterize as a flex. And Trump flexed expertly. And you could see it the way that, and this is important more for Asian audiences, but it's important to explain. If you watch the handshake, and I was on live TV explaining what you might see, and I said, hey, the best thing is, and what it should be, is Trump is the senior in this relationship. He stands still, and it's Xi Jinping that comes across the stage to him as the party that is coming to pay respects to, or to request the meeting with. And if you watch that, that's what happened. Now, the body language from the Chinese was not pleasant. It was all very clearly business. There's no warmness between these two. So the supposed commentary about a good friend known for a long time, I think the Chinese are dropping the veil on that. And I think we can expect a very challenging road ahead in negotiations on trade, security, and others like fentanyl.
It's interesting. I remember I used to be in part of the U.S. delegation to ASEAN, and I'll never forget that every one of the member states would speak English. It was sort of the universal language. The only country that would not speak English was the Chinese delegate. And he spoke English, you know, expertly, but he would always speak Chinese and then have his Chinese translator translate. And it was, you know, it was simply as a, like you say, like a flex to say, we're not going to give in to, you know, the United States by agreeing to speak, you know, the language of the United States. And so it's interesting to see how in these, you know, sort of these little ways, China asserts itself, and to see how China does more or less of that with President Trump, who is, you know, he's very clearly proven that he's willing to use force. You know, he's done it in Iran. He's done it repeatedly in, you know, in the Gulf of America and the Pacific against, you know, the drug cartels. And, you know, in many respects, like when the strikes in Asia, those, you know, those very well could be, you know, against boats shipping fentanyl or the precursor chemicals that then become, you know, mixed to become fentanyl in drug labs in Mexico. So it's interesting to kind of watch this dance between the two global leaders. So were there any specific items on the agenda that were really important to settle? And did those items get settled?
We don't know the full context of what the two discussed after the reporters were ushered out of the room. We do know that, of course, fentanyl did come up. We do know that there was, because of the pause on tariffs, or at least the modest reduction, just for those tariffs associated with fentanyl. It's not, if you look at the overall tariffs, it's a modest decrement, very small, like a few percentage points. So we do know that fentanyl was brought up. We know that Taiwan was not raised. Trump was not going to bring it up, and the Chinese didn't bring it up. So Taiwan's was not, I mean, it's an obvious question, but it didn't come up. Another issue that didn't come up that was kind of surprising is the tensions in South China Sea, specifically Chinese activities around Scarborough Shoal near the Philippines, which are continuing, unabated. It was interesting, but there's still it seemed to be a meeting that was going to focus on what was the issue at hand and how to actually get to a better place on trade to try to set the relationship on a more positive trajectory. And I think that was the emphasis of President Trump, not Xi Jinping, mind you, but from President Trump and his characterization of like a 12 on a scale of 10 for the meeting. In other words, they had a better understanding. I mean, they agreed. It's they had a better understanding of each other's hard points. The one that was also kind of surprising, and I view this as a very classic kind of Chinese play. Maybe I'm wrong on this, but it feels like what I witnessed for many years in Asia, and that is they've started a crackdown on Chinese Christians, and this has been reaching a crescendo in the weeks before Trump and Xi met. Typically, this would be like, oh, we'll release a few of these as a goodwill gesture. Now, why don't you give us something, America? That didn't happen. And maybe they talked about it behind screens, but it's something the Chinese should be forced to do because they also agreed to freedom of religion and they're abrogating that their treaty or their obligations to that human right now. So nothing need be conceded to them to do the right thing with regards to Chinese Christians.
This episode of NucleCast is brought to you by the AMLA Deterrence Center, whose mission is to educate Americans about the nuclear enterprise and strategic deterrence. Yeah, this was you remember back to the Cold War. and in the Soviet Union, this was a sort of a standard for both Jews and Christians, where President Reagan would push them, you know, for example, to let Jews immigrate to Israel, to release religious persecuted Russian citizens. And so, you know, here we are in China, and we're seeing, and particularly Christianity, which is perceived as a Western importation to China. So it's, like we said before, it's kind of one of those issues where the Chinese are flexing and putting pressure to see, you know, how will the United States react? And it's really kind of important in understanding the Chinese that, you know, they pressure to see how you respond constantly, and then they move where the opportunity exists.
Mm-hmm. Oh, totally.
So let me shift. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, it's been remarkable to watch from childhood, growing up in Asia, and seeing how American political leaders and policymakers have shifted over time to a much more nuanced and much more realist and deeper understanding and appreciations for how things are done in Asia. So the days of kind of playing this kind of game with American leadership, I think, is done. And it's not a partisan thing. You saw that beginnings of that in Obama. We saw it mature in Trump's first term, saw parts of this also come out in Biden. So American leadership has gotten smart and wise to how to do and engage with the Chinese.
Yeah. So now let's shift the topics again, and let's talk about maritime issues. What are some of the big maritime issues that are at play right now?
Oh, well, the most obvious one is the narco cartel interdiction attacks that are going on in the Caribbean and the Pacific. I definitely think as long as these attacks are focused in offshore and international water and airspace, we're hitting the cartels and attacking their business model. Because if they can't move product to market, they go out of business. And you're already starting to see some violence flare up because they're starting to turn on themselves. And I think this is somewhat to be expected as these very ruthless, thuggish organizations try to survive as their cash flow gets turned off. So that's one. Illegal fishing, which in some cases is the same groups at sea, like the Chinese distant fishing fleet that's been operating all over the world and poaching in many people's waters from West Africa to the coast off of Argentina, and even to include off up and around the Galapagos Islands in the Pacific and from Ecuador. So illegal fishing is a big issue. It's also a vector for a lot of other bad things like human trafficking and perhaps moving in counterfeit cigarettes as well as narcotics. Those are some of the big ones and I probably stop on that because that covers quite a lot that's going on at sea. And I didn't even mention piracy until just now.
So are these issues that are, you and I may talk about them, but are they kind of reaching that level where President Trump has said, hey, these are, I mean, we know he's sinking drug boats. That's one of the things we know. And we're kind of waiting to see whether he's going to take action on land and strike the cartels. But, are some of these other issues, you know, we dealt with piracy off the coast of Somalia for a while. We've dealt with, the Iranians have caused some troubles in the Bab el-Mandeb. And, so what else are they, what else are we concerned with? And sort of what is that rack and stack of priorities?
Yeah, I'll start with, there's really two that I'd want to focus in on. One is the fighting in the Red Sea is not over yet. The Houthis are still taking pot shots at shipping. So it's going to be important to keep the Iranians from moving weapons back into the Houthis so they can't get, resupply their stock of weapons. So it's going to take a while. And hopefully some of our European partners who are more directly affected by the shutdown of the Red Sea to their shipping, they're more directly affected by this, that they actually are much more present in suppressing the Houthis' attacks against shipping international waters there. The piracy is kind of wrapped into that because these smugglers are the ones that are moving weapons into Yemen to the Houthis from Iran. And so it's really kind of a shared space, shared platforms. But that's kind of, it's become a tertiary, a third level issue right now, thankfully, alongside with moving cargo out of the Black Sea. I mean, we had talked about global hunger because of the grain shipments out of Ukraine. We seem to have gotten to a stable place, even as that war continues to flare up right now. The Russians are continuing to press the advantage. So the Black Sea is kind of, again, like a third level issue, but it's there and it could bounce up to the top at any moment. But the illegal fishing is the one that's kind of always there in the background and it never seems to break out. I think the time of that is actually coming to a close. American waters in the Pacific are expansive. And the Chinese distant fishing fleet is massive, like thousands of these ships that just hoover up, vacuum up sea life. And that actually depletes the livelihood and even the food supply for many of these Pacific Islanders. Many of them, American citizens, mind you, or very close partners and allies of the United States. And so we're talking billions and billions of dollars in the seafood market, just in the Pacific that we know about. Alaska, Hawaii are also potentially affected by this. Huge waters, lots of fish worth $1 billion to $2 billion just in the catches off Alaska alone. So, and you add in money of that scale affecting American citizens, it becomes a political issue that our Congress members will want to see addressed. So I think those days are coming.
Yeah, that's a good point. Well, now we're at that time in the show where we bring out Bob the genie. So as I rub my magic lamp, Bob, of course, grants 3 wishes to all guests. And of course, you know, as you know, you got to keep those wishes related to the topics of discussion. So with that in mind, Brent, what is your first wish?
The first wish is that we get the rest of the maritime team in place and the administration. These are the captains of change. Steve Carmel, I hope to see him get confirmed and in place as the maritime administrator. I think that's the top of the, that's number one.
Yeah, that's are we in a position now where we don't have the folks that we need in place to ensure, you know, this, you know, sort of the good decisions are made for commercial shipping and, you know, our maritime interest?
Yeah, well, we're okay. Missing. So the White House, the National Security Council was a good place because when Mike Waltz was in there as the National Security Advisor to the president, he had control over National Security Council. So he created a shipbuilding office. It would have been better if it was between the two and then it got disestablished. So the White House needs to have kind of an interagency coordinator because shipbuilding, shipping, it's a national security issue and it's an economic issue. So hopefully we'll see an administrator, a special advisor for maritime issues to the president. It's in draft legislation to do just that. I know folks are thinking about it. I think they need to do it sooner because we're getting to execution phase in this revival of American maritime strength. But over in Navy, we haven't even got a name yet for the Assistant Secretary of the Navy for Research, Development, Acquisition. This is the guy or gal responsible for naval shipbuilding. You need that person in there working with Steve Carmel over at the Maritime Administration and the Coast Guard and the White House to kind of make sure that we're doing right by the industry and getting warships out of the yards and back out to sea on time. It's a team effort, and we don't have the team players on the field.
Yeah, that's a good point. Okay, so how about wish number two?
Wish number two, I would wish for a reestablishment of a first fleet. It doesn't have to be as big as the other numbered fleets, but a 3-star admiral and a small staff based on one of the ships that are rotationally deployed out of Sepangar in Singapore. They could bounce around Australia to help with AUKUS and HMAS Stirling down in Perth in Western Australia, go up and establish facilities and support networks in the Philippines, Malaysia. So first fleet, bring me back first fleet focused in on Southeast Asia.
Yeah, that's a good point. But, you know, I wonder, do we have the capacity right now to do that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, so we had an extra, I mean, there was a staff that was recently stood up a few years back when I was still in the Navy to a 3-star. It was used. It didn't exist before. Or the N7 that no longer exists, by the way. It's been folded into other stuff. But we've got enough 3-star admirals in the Pentagon. Take one of them. Give them an operational command. A, they love it. B, it sends the right signal to our friends in the region that we're serious. And there's already a flagship that's bouncing around in effect. So we have these EPFs. They're old ferry ships that have been turned into military logistics support ships. The admiral in charge of 7th Fleet back in 2018 repurposed one of these that rotate through Singapore as a flagship, as his actual flagship. The USS Blue Ridge was in a major overhaul. So done it before, can do it again. The ship is there. The staff is already ready to go. They just take the Southeast Asia action officers off of 7th Fleet. It's like about 5 of them. You bring a few reservists. You get that 3-star admiral and maybe bring in a lieutenant or two to run the front office. You've got a reconstituted 1st Fleet to begin with, you know, and then it can grow as appropriate in time.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll work on that one. That'll be one Bob, I think, can handle. Okay. So yeah. How about your final wish?
The final wish, and it's one big wish to rule them all, and it's a naval act. And the Naval Act, I think I wished on this before. So your genie didn't give me my wish last time. So I'm wishing again. The Naval Act still is important. And so you've got ships that we know the Navy is confident in, have been built for many years, or the design is already pretty stable. So I'm talking about Virginia-class submarines, the Ford-class aircraft carrier, the Arleigh Burke destroyers, the Virginia-class submarine, which I may have already mentioned, but These are ships that are already on the order books that we know the Navy still needs 10 of in the next 5 years. And when you buy like in a package, like, you know, bundle your cable bill, you take advantage of economies of scale. You can reduce the cost because it gives more predictability to the shipbuilder. So just bundle in the 5-year plan all the ships that you want to build. It's about 45 to 47 of them of stable designs. Write a check and say, start delivering me the ships. That's in essence what the Naval Act is. There's details in there. I've worked out all of the details down to extreme minutia, but that's my third and final wish. Give me a Naval Act for 45 Navy ships so we can get a good price and start getting ships on time delivered.
All right. Well, we'll work on that. So Brent Sadler, thanks for joining us again on NucleCast. It's been great to have you. It's great to get an update on some important topics that are in the news as of late. So thanks for being here.
No, thank you for having me on your show today.
And thanks to you, the listeners, and we'll see you next time.
This has been a production of the NY Deterrence Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent. Our executive producer is Kimberly Charrington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Frunthal. Help us grow our followers by sharing it and follow the show on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at NucleCast.